some disarray as well. And of course, it was in this context, late 17th, but particularly 18th centuries, that European powers, ultimately headed by the English, began to interfere increasingly successfully in Indian affairs. The British, and particularly the British East India Company, was able to take advantage of growing Mughal weakness to establish a growing British beachhead in the continent itself. The British were able to develop alliances with other Indian rulers hostile to each other or hostile to the Mughals that further British rule without the commitment of vast forces. The later 18th century saw the increasing conversion of much of India to essentially a British colony, a huge change, obviously, in Indian history, a huge expansion of European imperial presence taking shape at the end of the early modern period. The Ottoman Empire presents a different picture, although Europeans sometimes tried to argue that it wasn't as different as might seem. The Ottoman Empire undoubtedly reached a high point in the late 16th and 17th centuries. A last effort at territorial expansion occurred in the 1680s as Ottoman troops twice attacked Vienna, hoping to press farther into Central Europe. These attacks failed. And from that point onward, the Ottomans suffered a periodic series of territorial setbacks, partly at the hands of Austro-Hungarians, who pressed the empire back from the Habsburg territories, but even more at the hands of the Russians in patterns that we discussed in our previous session. Ottoman territorial setbacks, obviously, pressed the empire in other ways. It became harder to reward loyal top bureaucrats and generals. Many parts of the empire became increasingly parceled out among chief administrators who might milk the province for personal advantage. Corruption and economic dislocation increased. But the Ottoman Empire was still in many ways quite healthy and would remain healthy well into the 19th century. It wasn't as vibrant as it had been before. On the other hand, in no sense was it on its last legs. But there was one further development that was interesting as well. By the 18th century, sensing Ottoman weakness and also undoubtedly exploiting an older prejudice against Islam, European opinion began to decide that the Ottoman rule was both sick and weak. And this European impression that this was an empire cruel to its subjects, cruel to women, but also on its last legs, was a perception that would create a reality of its own during the 19th century and affect Europe's relations with the Middle East in its own right. Developments in China, much more complex. In most respects, in fundamental respects, the Chinese state and economy remained quite vigorous up until the 1830s. For example, it was only in the 1830s and 40s that the European balance of payments situation vis-a-vis China finally altered so that Europe began to be able to take precious metals from China rather than paying them in return for Chinese goods. But there were some signs. They were modest. This is a state that's still vigorous and successful. There were some signs of trouble. Probably by the 18th century, China was beginning to be burdened by overpopulation, fed by new food supplies, an overpopulation that could require so many resources to sustain itself that it would affect larger economic dynamism and economic growth. Certainly, China ceased being, even apart from its relative position vis-a-vis Europe, China ceased being a source of major technological innovation at this point. There's some sense as well that cultural creativity lagged somewhat. Chinese intellectuals were still vigorously reproducing earlier literary forms and discussing Confucian traditions. This was not a cultural collapse, but new influences, new interpretations of older themes probably declined somewhat. The empire may also have been affected by excessive bureaucratization, excessive levels of paperwork that made decision-making difficult, that made communication with the provinces sometimes cumbersome. Again, none of this would come home to roost still for several decades, but in retrospect, we can see some possible signs of trouble. One thing is clear, particularly with regard to China and the Ottoman Empire. A possible source of renewal which Russia was pursuing, albeit amid complexity, as we discussed in our previous session. A possible source of renewal was not pursued, and that was the possibility of selectively looking at developments in the West as a pattern for certain kinds of possible reforms. China, in fact, which had been open to modest Western missionary activity in much of the early modern period, which had been interested as somewhat of a curiosity, but a bit more than that, in Western developments such as clocks and other scientific discoveries, Chinese openness to even modest Western presence definitely turned sour in the early 18th century, with increasing restrictions on missionaries, persecutions of small groups of Chinese Christians. This was not a path that China chose to take. Participation in trade remained vigorous, but there was, if anything, a retreat from an interest in contacts of other sorts. The Ottoman Empire, which was even more aware of developments in the West because individual Ottomans traveled frequently to Western Europe, there was no barrier of communication here at all. The Ottoman Empire also rather systematically avoided the possibility of influential contacts with the West. For example, the printing press, which had obviously been established in Western Europe long since, the printing press was banned from the Ottoman Empire until toward the middle of the 18th century, when it was first allowed only for Christians, not for Muslims. And the reason, obviously, was not just blanket rejection of the West. The reason, obviously, was a government desire to make sure as possible, that it had control over access to information and ideology. Gradually, this was loosened, but pretty late in the game. The only Western influence that was directly incorporated by Ottoman rulers, interestingly enough, were Western doctors who were called upon to service the Ottoman court, even though, as far as one can determine, they were no more effective in actual medical practice than were the physicians in the rich traditions of the Middle East, a sort of cultural fad that had no clear practical basis. We have then a situation in the great states of Asia, in which during most of the early modern period, significant vigor developed, significant achievements were registered, but in a pattern in which gains were somewhat overshadowed, as we now know, by the greater vigor of developments in the West. And we have a situation where markedly to tentatively, certain signs of absolute decline begin to show as well. There's one final case that deserves attention that actually, to some extent, interestingly contrasts with the gunpowder empire developments we've been emphasizing thus far. The early modern period was a crucial one in Japanese history. As we've discussed previously, after some flirtation with Western contacts, Japanese leaders decided at the end of the 16th century largely to close off contacts, not entirely, but largely, and emphasize a pattern of internal economic, political, and cultural development. This was the period that becomes known as the Tokugawa Shogunate, which would last until 1868. Under the Tokugawa Shogunate, feudalism persisted. The ritual apparatus of feudalism was carefully preserved along with the social privileges of feudal lords, but alongside feudalism, and in fact more effective than feudalism, began to be the apparatus of a small but definite central state, serviced by its own bureaucracy, not feudal vassals, and capable of reducing, in most cases, eliminating internal warfare, providing increasing political unity, which was in turn the framework for the rather successful expansion of commercial activity within Japan that we have discussed before. This was obviously a significant and, as it turned out, fairly durable political change in Japanese affairs that marked increasing political effectiveness and a de facto modification of feudalism that was quite significant. Cultural change accompanied this development as well. Even though Japan's intense interactions with China were things of the past, the Japanese actually, during this early modern period, turned increasingly toward Confucianism. Buddhism survived and could be vigorous in some instances. The more traditional religion of Shintoism survived as well, though it probably faded somewhat. But cultural emphases shifted increasingly to a Japanese version of Confucianism that had two consequences that would be significant for the future as well. Consequence number one was simply an increasing secularization of Japanese culture. Not an entire secularization, but as Confucianism spread, this worldly concerns began to predominate in Japanese culture, along, by the way, with some interesting new artistic forms that would mark further steps in Japanese cultural identity as well. The second implication of the Japanese version of Confucianism, though it became fully clear only in the first half of the 19th century, was an increasing commitment to the importance of education, not just for a Confucian upper class, but for broader bands of society and what we would call the middle classes and even somewhat below. Japanese Confucianism ended up, not immediately, but over time, ended up encouraging an educational commitment that would lead Japan to be the second society after that of the West in literacy rates by the early 19th century, a very interesting pattern that, again, reflects considerable cultural dynamism in Japan itself. These patterns in Japan obviously differed from those in other parts of East Asia, particularly China. The shogunate emphasized a growing importance of the central state, but feudalism was still quite real. Japanese version of Confucianism was somewhat distinctive, particularly in its ultimate educational emphasis. Japanese population policy, or Japanese population behavior, was also somewhat distinctive. During the 18th century, Japanese population did not grow massively, did not overcome available resources, as was beginning to be suggested in China. A fairly extensive use of abortion, among other things, seems to have limited Japanese population growth. And most interestingly of all for the future, the Japanese in the 18th century began to become slightly more open to outside influence rather than less. Decisions were made to exploit the contacts with Dutch merchants and what was called the Dutch School of Translators in Japan, people who learned Dutch in order to have the capability of interaction with the Europeans. This contact was exploited to allow the translation of scientific and medical works into Japanese, not other works yet, but an indication that the Japanese were sufficiently aware of what was going on in the outside world, that they saw that there was a need to take at least some opportunity to figure out what these developments might portend for Japan itself. The patterns that we've been discussing don't overturn conventional views of Asian history in the early modern period entirely. Again, relative decline is undeniable as long as it doesn't overwhelm an understanding that there were important positive developments during much of this period. Asia was not simply sitting around waiting for Western control and guidance. This was a series of independent kingdoms capable of significant achievements. Specific decline of specific regimes, most notably in Mughal India, has to be registered as well. But the larger sense that somehow this was a crucial period in which Asia began to be backward, isolated, whatever the term, this sense is simply wrong. Which leads to one final question. Why care? World historians, particularly experts on Asia and the world economy, have vigorously insisted that we need to redress this impression of Asian economic inferiority, backwardness, etc. And I think the reasons are twofold. One is, presumably, it's better to be accurate than not. And when we have knowledge of things like Chinese acquisition of New World silver, we need to exploit it because otherwise we're simply pandering to error. And I guess I would argue that in itself is a bad thing. But point two, we need to redress this impression because it so panders to older Western prejudices about Asian characteristics. It reflects a very brief sense of Western superiority. If we realize that Asia remained a vital contributor to world history up until at least the 18th and even into the 19th centuries, and then would again become a vital contributor to world history by the 20th century, the period of Asian eclipse, if that's even an appropriate term, is very brief indeed. And this we have to know, whatever our views about historical accuracy, as a means of understanding Western-Asian relations and Asian concerns about Western opinion, even in the present day.
Lecture 24, The Long 19th Century.
In this session, we introduce the next major period in world history, which runs from about 1750 until 1914. The term that is increasingly used for this period is, borrowed from a British historian, Eric Hobsbawm, the Long 19th Century. Obviously pretty long, but nevertheless focused on the 19th century. This period shades off from the early modern period in several ways, although, as I mentioned before, there's no decisive break. In the first place, two of the features of the early modern period now no longer really have much effect in world affairs. The Columbian Exchange had set up some enduring population patterns, but the immediate effects of the Columbian Exchange are long gone by the later 18th century, except again in the Pacific region, where something of the same phenomenon was repeating itself. The formation of the gunpowder empires, at least the land-based gunpowder empires, is also no longer a dominant theme because, and this began to unravel in the late early modern period itself, many of the gunpowder empires are now in increasing trouble or vanishing altogether. So two early modern themes are pretty well gone. On the other hand, two themes persist recognizably. One is the rise of the West, which continues and even accelerates vis-a-vis other societies in the long 19th century. And two is the shape of the world economy, which in fact becomes clearer during this period as well. This then is conventionally taken as a new period. I once tried to combine it with the early modern, but the convention simply worked against it. And it does have some new features in addition to redefined continuities from the early modern. The two big developments, and they're closely linked, the two big developments that frame the long 19th century, beginning in the later 18th century itself, are one, the emergence of the Industrial Revolution, and two, its brief but decisive monopoly by the West. The Industrial Revolution is, in and of itself, a great big deal. It introduced a new economic form as decisively different from agriculture as agriculture was from hunting and gathering. With industrialization, human productive power increased vastly, primarily because of the use of fossil fuels and other sources of power than humans and animals. Industrialization was a big deal because it concentrated work and people in factories and cities. Not surprisingly, industrial societies fairly quickly, Britain was the first in 1850, reached a 50% mark of urbanization, which, by the way, the world as a whole just reached in 2006, but an indication of the ongoing trend. The Industrial Revolution was a big deal because it transformed even intimate aspects of life. For example, childhood. Childhood in agricultural economies, as we emphasized, was mainly focused on work. And briefly, in the Industrial Revolution, that pattern might seem to continue. But pretty quickly, it was realized that childhood and work in the factories did not mix. So childhood was redefined yet again as meaning primarily schooling, something that we're still assimilating even today. Almost every aspect of life was touched by the Industrial Revolution, and as it began to take shape, first in Britain, then in other parts of Western Europe and the United States, late 18th, early 19th centuries, this does call attention to a major marker. But the second point is equally crucial. The long 19th century itself is shaped not only by the Industrial Revolution, but by the extent to which, for a brief time, Western societies monopolized the process. Again, brevity is crucial here. Ultimately, it is absolutely vital to see the Industrial Revolution as a global phenomenon in which all parts of the world participate, such that the European lead is, again, a brief and ultimately probably not terribly significant one. But for the long 19th century itself, the enhancement of European power by industrialization and by the fact that most other societies simply did not move immediately in an industrialization direction, this set a framework to which every society had in one way or another to react. Even in its European monopoly, the Industrial Revolution was already in crucial ways global. It was caused, in part, by global connections. Europeans industrialized in part because they'd already learned that an emphasis on producing processed goods was a good way to make money in the world economy. Producing processed goods in factories simply enhanced and augmented that advantage. Global relationships also had helped pile up capital in European coffers that was available for the expensive, modest by contemporary standards, but by the standards of time, quite expensive investments in industrial apparatus. Industrialization had a global impact also immediately. For example, in causing the deindustrialization of local industries in places as different as India and Latin America, as British and European and American factories poured out cheap manufactured goods, particularly textiles, hundreds of thousands of domestic workers in places like Venezuela or India were thrown out of work, obviously forcing crucial economic adjustments in these regions as well as in the industrial societies themselves. Industrialization, European monopoly, shape the period in crucial respects. Two influences flow directly. In the first place, as Europe increasingly industrialized, it enhanced its demands on other parts of the world to produce cheap raw materials and foods and to accept increasingly expensive manufactured products, or at least increasingly available manufactured products. In other words, it increased the extent to which core and peripheral or somewhat peripheral relationships began to predominate not just in the Atlantic economy, which really had been the main focus of the early modern period, but worldwide. Latin America, for example, and we'll explore this a little more fully in a later session, Latin America, already a peripheral economy, saw more and more land and more workers poured into production for export, now not just of silver and sugar, though these continued, but also coffee, also rubber, also fertilizer, also a variety of products that still depended on low cost, that still yielded a fairly modest profit to the society as a whole, though still considerable wealth for individual business people or landowners. This relationship already established was now vastly extended. And as the relationship was extended, the gap between core societies and peripheral societies widened as well. For example, in 1800, the average Mexican had a standard of living about two-thirds that of the average citizen of the new United States. In 1900, because the average American in a core society became wealthier and the average Mexican in a peripheral society became poorer, that relationship was one-third, a really significant change reflecting movement in both directions. Africa was now deeply affected by the world economy with an interesting and in some ways unexpected twist. The 19th century, and we'll explore this more fully in the next session, the 19th century abolished the slave trade and significantly limited, therefore, the principal African sale to the world economy in the early modern period. Yet African attachment to the receipt of European goods, guns, etc., continued, thus resulting in an African scramble to identify other products that might sell in the world market, such as vegetable oil, palm oil, cotton, other products not always totally suitable to the African environment, products that also, again, demanded larger amounts of cheap labor, such that for a moment, ironically, slavery actually expanded in 19th century Africa itself. Every part of the world was touched by this relationship, either becoming more peripheral in the first place or expanding peripheral characteristics, as was the pattern in Latin America. European and American thirst for cheap goods, ultimately including even some cheap manufactured products. Their capacity to pay for these goods with an outpouring of manufactured products of their own set the world economic relationship into a global framework. The second consequence, and it really does relate pretty closely to industrialization, the second consequence of this new pattern was an extension of European or Western military advantage from the seas to the land as well. Sea-based power remained crucial. This was the dominant source of Western military threat in the early modern period, and it obviously expands with better guns, larger ships, steamships, etc. But now a series of developments also opened up the possibility of land-based military dominance as well. These innovations included the development of smaller and more mobile field artillery, already used before industrialization outright, for example, by Napoleon in the French Revolutionary Wars. The developments included the early 19th century emergence of the repeating rifle and the possibility, which both British and American inventors helped develop, the possibility of producing this repeating rifle through the standardization of parts on a mass scale. Developments included by the middle of the century, the emergence of early forms of the machine gun, i.e., these developments made it possible for small numbers of Western troops, sometimes literally a few score, to hold off sometimes several thousands, even tens of thousands, of troops armed in more conventional fashion, as would occur in the European imperialist burst in Africa. Land-based military advantage was enhanced as well by transportation improvements. Steamships, and in a few cases railroads, allowed Westerners to ship troops and materiel long distances in fairly rapid order, and obviously the telegraph, by providing communication links as well, contributed here. Riverboats, steam-driven, now could plow up river, which was critically important for European military penetration both of China and of Africa. And, though more in the later 19th century, the development of new tropical medicines added another ingredient that facilitated Western military interaction with key parts of the world. Add these two things together, and one has first a series of major crises in which the new Western military edge over other societies was demonstrated, crises that also quickly turned into larger patterns of economic exploitation as well. Event number one, 1798. Napoleon, briefly freed from much to do back in Europe, takes a French expeditionary force and invades Egypt, conquering Egypt fairly easily. He doesn't stay there because the British chase him out. But the ease with which European forces could conquer one of the heartland areas of the Islamic world was not lost on Egyptians or on the Ottomans more generally. They didn't quite know what to do about it, but the balance between European military authority and Middle Eastern military power had clearly been dramatically altered. Crisis number two, the First Opium War in China, 1839. The British finally, in the 1830s, found a good that they could produce quite easily, other than simply transporting New World silver, that would get them access to Chinese markets. This good was opium, produced in British territories in India. The British insisted that the Chinese accept opium and open their markets more generally. The Chinese government, weak now but still with some voice, resisted British demands, and the result was a conflict in which British and other Western troops easily overcame Chinese forces and pried open, at least began to pry open, this market both for opium, which was the widest selling single good in the 19th century world trade, and for European and Western activities more generally. Crisis number three. In 1853, an American fleet under Admiral Perry sailed into Edo Bay in Japan, Tokyo Bay, and demanded that the Japanese open them.